and welcome to Worlds Apart. Throughout history, humanity has tried many times to solve problems by means that have not only exacerbated the pre-existing challenges, but also created much bigger ones. Take nuclear weapons, for example. Born out of the need for security, they come with the risk of total annihilation. My guest today argues that our efforts to deal with climate change fall into a similar pattern, at times doing more harm than good. Why is it so difficult to prevent the treatment from becoming the disease in its own right? Well, to discuss that, I'm now joined by Judith Curry, an American climatologist and professor emerita at the Georgia Institute of Technology. Professor Curry, it's amazing to talk to you. Thank you very much for being available.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
Now, in one of your articles, you wrote that, and let me quote here, "All things considered, planet Earth is doing fine. Humans are doing better than at any other time in history." And I think it sounds incredulous in our era of almost paramount doomsday anxiety. Why are you so chill?
Population, you know, over the last 100 years, population has substantially increased. Poverty has reduced substantially globally. Agricultural productivity is way up. Fewer people per capita are dying from weather and climate related disasters. The planet is greening. It seems to enjoy the warmer temperatures and the additional carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. So overall, it seems like we've done pretty well over the past century during a period when the planet has been warming. Mm-hmm. So yeah, that warming is dangerous, I think, is the weakest part of the whole argument. Mm-hmm.
But isn't it also true that while we have witnessed all this technological progress, our requirements of safety and security have increased dramatically, and people are far less tolerant not only of the real dangers, but even of basic uncertainty, which our ancestors took for granted? I wonder if that in and of itself necessitates postulating some major danger that would be a sort of a, you know, a designated aggregate for all the existential anxiety.
Exactly. It's a convenient climate. Global warming, fossil fueled warming, has become a convenient scapegoat for, you know, all of the planet's problems. You know, whenever there is a water resource shortage, they don't blame poor water management, bad governance, or extravagant use of water. Instead, they blame climate change. So by blaming climate change for everything that goes wrong, we ignore the real causes of many of our problems.
So Professor Curry, is it just a scapegoat to escape responsibility, or is it also in a way a Trojan horse to smuggle in some hidden vested interests?
Oh, well, it's driven by a particular worldview, a neo-Malthusian worldview that, you know, humans are a blight on the planet, that the environment is fragile, and the only way that we can deal with all this is through non-government world control, through organizations like the United Nations, World Economic Forum, etc. At the end of the day, to me, this looks like a big power grab rather than something that's going to help humanity.
Mm-hmm. Well, given the state of relations between Russia and the United States, you can hardly suppose that the Kremlin is in the pockets of Washington activist. And yet, I think, you know, some people here are also not necessarily share the entire debate, but they do see temperature changing and extreme weather events. Is there any relation between new weather phenomena that we witness and climate change?
We've had extreme weather and climate events for, you know, for several billion years that the Earth has been in existence. We've always had bad weather. We currently have bad weather, and we'll have bad weather in the future. There's even the UN climate assessment reports finds no relationship between extreme weather events and global warming, apart from heat waves. That's the only one that seems to be increasing, and that makes sense if the overall temperature is increasing. But hurricanes, floods, droughts, hail, you know, whatever bad weather that often gets blamed on fossil fueled warming. Even the UN climate assessment reports finds low confidence in any trend, let alone anything that can be blamed on fossil fuel warming.
But I don't mean only quote unquote bad weather, because here in Russia, for example, we have witnessed some unprecedented, unheard of weather phenomena. For example, over the last couple of years, we've been witnessing a lot of what we call ice rain, when temperatures fall precipitously during the rainfall, creating essentially huge ice rings. And that could be very unpredictable and also very traumatic, especially for the elderly. And I've heard that other countries also experience something like that, a phenomena that they either never experienced before or perhaps have forgotten about. Do you think there is any relation between this like unheard of things and what we see happening with the atmosphere globally?
The key point is forgotten about. For example, in the U.S., bad weather, everything from the worst heat waves, the worst droughts, even the worst landfalling hurricanes, occurred in the 1930s. Okay, and that is outside of most people's living memory, but it's there in the records. And if you look back further, you know, into the 1800s, you will find all sorts of crazy weather. So the key point is forgotten about. You know, there are natural variations in weather and climate extremes, and some of these are multi-decadal, so it may be, you may have to go back 60, 70 years, 150 years before you find something comparable, but it's very rare that you find a completely new weather event that's unprecedented.
So do I understand you correctly that climate and weather patterns are maybe changing simply because nature always changes? It's never static, and claiming that it's all due to human activity may be not only misleading, but perhaps a little bit grandiose.
Even if you just look back 100 years rather than one person's living memory, you will find lots of extreme weather events. You'll see lots of natural weather and climate variability. So this is nothing unusual. People have just been fed the hype that, you know, fossil fuels cause bad weather, and it's just ludicrous, but people have bought it somehow.
Well, at least people in the United States are more largely within the Western world. And I do want to ask you a sort of a cultural, I guess, question, because to a Russian, and I think more broadly foreign eye, the American debate on climate change is characterized by implausibly high predictions of emissions and the sort of theorized harm that they may cause. And most governments around the world tend to stay on the conservative side of the forecast in their policy settings, simply because the resources are limited and there are many present day issues competing for those resources. But I think in the United States, we see a totally different trend. I mean, there is a predilection for the most dramatic forecasts possible, and not only on climate change. Take for example the public health debate and all the COVID projections. They were also hugely overboard. Do you think that's a cultural issue, or is it perhaps an ideological one?
Even the UN climate assessment reports have focused on the extreme emission scenario and the very warm, you know, that gives a whole lot of warming and exaggerates the extreme weather events. But even the Conference of the Parties climate negotiators abandoned these extreme emission scenarios in 2021. So why are the scientists still using them? And it's not just U.S. scientists. There's a very healthy contingent of what I would call alarmist scientists in Europe, particularly in Germany, many in the UK, for example. So it's not just a US phenomenon. And there are a lot of motives. I mean, individual scientists get far more attention and funding and whatever if they make an alarming pronouncement. I mean, it gets them more attention. They have seats at the big tables, you know, making policy and things like that. So there's various social motives for people to exaggerate in the U.S. and in Europe. And I think it's becoming more and more apparent that, you know, something is very wrong, and that there's a growing move just to abandon the extreme emission scenarios and look at conservative scenarios. And I have to say the Russian climate model has one of the lowest sensitivities to CO2 emissions. And I think it's one of the better climate models out there, giving more real projections.
Well, since you mentioned that, I think at least within the Russian collective psyche, there is a due to our Soviet past, I think, and the sort of outlandish plans that we were striving for at that time, there is now a very clear distinction between trying to influence and trying to control. We can influence lots of things to varying degrees, but we cannot control them absolutely. And yet, I think this is what Western policy is premised on, the demand for hegemony, not only as a geopolitical concept, but also as a something that, you know, humans need to have. Isn't that one of the reasons why the climate change narrative and perhaps, as I said, many other issues like public health, international policy, etc., have become so intolerant to opposing points of view or even, you know, scientific data that does not agree with the dogmatic proposition?
Yes, you hit on a key point. Basically, they've tried to characterize like pandemic management and control of the climate as simple problems. You know, these are things that we can control. And in fact, these are wicked problems, deeply complex, a lot of uncertainty and a lot of ambiguity in the values surrounding the issue. And so, you know, for a problem like climate change or a pandemic, I mean, we have to abandon the idea that we can control it, but we need to seek to understand and then manage the impacts. I mean, control it maybe to a certain extent, but not in any substantial way. And so we just abandon the idea that we can control these things.
Well, at least you and me, we can control our conversation to some extent in the sense of taking a short break right now, but we will be back to this fascinating discussion in a few moments. Stay tuned.
Despite everything, brave priests go to the front lines where they're eagerly awaited. They pray in the trenches, in bunkers, in hospitals, and in destroyed churches. They pray for peace.
Десантники говорят, мы в тельняшках, а мы со Христом. И Христос посреди нас и есть и будет. Все, ничего сокровенного, все просто и понятно.
Моя задача – помочь, поддержать, вот, удержать, выслушать, как отец родной, обнять солдат.
Когда ты участвуешь в богослужении, присутствуешь, исповедуешь себя, причащаешься, святых святых тайн, то понимаешь Бога в себе. Конечно, ты с Богом, ты воодушевлен, ты счастлив. Благодать Божия спускается с небес и вселяется в душу человека, воина, солдата.
Милуй, Господи, помилуй, Господи, помилуй.
Welcome back to Worlds Apart with Judith Curry, an American climatologist and professor emerita at the Georgia Institute of Technology. Professor Curry, just before the break, we were talking about, or rather you were talking about, the need to abandon the attempts to control everything and instead focus on adapting on whatever Mother Nature brings our way. But I think that would require a lot of humility, perhaps, and a certain degree of tolerance of uncertainty. How do you think those values could be sort of brought back into the public debate, at least on climate change?
You know, the uncertainty issue is out there, and by trying to ignore it or minimize it or frame a problem, you know, so narrowly that uncertainty, you know, doesn't seem so large, I mean, it's just a very, very big mistake. And it's very bad for policymaking. In scientific discourse, when there are sort of political values in play, there's always a lot of uncertainty, and disagreement is the spice of academic life. And, you know, nothing is ever settled. And, you know, that's how the scientific process normally works. But when politics come into play, no, everything becomes very overly certain, and you have tribal communities develop who try to cancel each other and marginalize each other. And we've seen this in the academic climate debate, and it's a very pernicious thing, not only for science, but also for the policymaking process, where policymakers are simply misled, thinking that, you know, this is simple. We know how to fix the climate, and we have these very specific targets and timelines, and we need to meet them, and then bad weather will go away. Well, that's simply a fairy tale, and we need to acknowledge it and get on with trying to better understand the situation and to adapt to extreme weather events and climate variability and change.
Now, speaking about understanding this situation better, I know that the hallmark of your approach to climate and weather forecasts takes a particular attention to natural variability, such as volcanic eruptions, sun activity, ocean oscillations, etc. Why do you think it's important to take those parameters into account?
Well, because, you know, we've had climate variability, huge variations in climate on timescales from century to millennia to hundreds of millions of years. And these were not caused by fossil fuels. Okay, they were caused by natural processes involving volcanoes, the sun, ice sheets, and ocean circulations. And to all of a sudden trivialize those processes and blame everything on, you know, emission of fossil fuels is just kind of stupidity.
Now, correct me if I'm wrong, I think those processes move on very long scales, not only thousands of years, but perhaps even millennia. And a lot of studies are investigating them. But speaking generally, how well do we as humans understand what affects what within the planetary system?
Well, you know, unfortunately, we've lost two decades of research on trying to understand natural processes that contribute to climate variability, because everyone has been focused on the CO2 issue and global climate models. But the ocean oscillations, I think, are particularly relevant on scales from interannual to multi-decadal to multi-century, which are the time scale, same time scales that we're talking about in terms of fossil fuel emissions. So this is huge in terms of regional climate variability. You know, like the El Nino and La Nina are examples, and then there's, you know, decadal variabilities in the Atlantic and the Pacific Ocean and the Arctic Ocean, Southern Hemisphere. All of these things, the circulation patterns, heavily influence our climate and our regional extreme weather pattern. And we lost sight of this just by looking at globally average temperatures and CO2 emissions. Mm-hmm.
Now, from what you're saying, it looks like an area that almost requires authentic global cooperation. And I understand that the discourse on climate change within the West has been somewhat dogmatic. But what about international academia? Is it also under the pressure to conform to certain dogmas, or is it more sort of independent in its forecasts and conclusions?
Well, in Europe and Australia, I would say the situation is pretty much the same as in the U.S. You know, in Asia, things may be more open. I mean, I I would say in Asia, things are a bit more open. But I think as policymakers start abandoning the extreme emission scenarios, all the climate scientists are going to have to admit that natural climate variability is much more important than previous thought. Because if you have these extreme emission scenarios, they're so huge that, yeah, they swamp natural variability. But once you get back to reasonable emission scenario, then natural variability definitely becomes a major player.
Mm-hmm. And as far as I understand, you are already working in that field, advising companies or private businesses on how to go about their own decisions, how to invest their own money. And that may be sort of in not in the full agreement with the mainstream view. How much interest do you see to the kind of work that you do from private businesses? Do they buy into the dogma?
Okay, the people who are trying to meet some government regulations, you know, they're looking for the, you know, the main dogmatic kind of thing. But my clients are people who have a direct economic interest, or they have specific infrastructure that they're developing and they need to make sure that it can withstand whatever Mother Nature throws its way over the next 30, 50 years. Then they come to me and they say, okay, we've heard the hype. Now, we need to hear from you some scenarios about how this might really play out. A range of possible scenarios, the uncertainties, you know, give us the works, lay it out for us, you know. So when people have real decisions that impact, you know, economic or engineering or infrastructure related, they want to hear from me.
It's interesting. From what you're saying, they have to think not only about what Mother Nature throws their way, but what their government sort of imposes on that. And that may be a burden of its own kind, and perhaps even heavier than the natural situation.
Oh, exactly. I mean, we're in a situation right now where the cure is worse than the disease, particularly in the U.S. and Europe, with all the renewable energies and tearing down nuclear power plants and coal power plants, and, you know, and they're ruining the environment, and they're ending up with very reduced and unstable power generation, which is not helping anybody.
Well, but you just had the change of power in Washington, and I don't want to get us into the sort of political discussion, but I'm sure you heard some of the statements that Elon Musk, for example, who is prominent in the new Trump administration, has been making about the energy policy and the use of the renewables. From what I understand, his point of view is that he believes that there is a place for them within the energy balance, but they have to be backups by traditional energy sources. Are you in any way hopeful that there may be a change, not necessarily in policy, but at least in the way those issues are discussed?
I think rooftop solar power is a good solution, but offshore wind is probably the worst solution. And then with wind and solar farms, there's a niche for them in some regions. But that there is no way we're going to get around this without firm baseload power, either from fossil fuels, nuclear power, or maybe, you know, advanced geothermal or some new developments that are talked about. So mm-hmm. So we just need that. The Trump administration has a very forward-looking team of people looking at the energy issue, and I'm very optimistic that things will move forward in the U.S. in a sensible way.
Mm-hmm. Well, as things move forward in the United States, I also want to ask you about international policy, because over the last couple of decades, there has been a strong international drive towards some sort of a uniform climate or environmental treaty that would have, all countries agree to certain conditions regardless of their geographical, climate or economical situation. Do you think there is a need for some sort of a global agreement on those issues, or are they better addressed on a regional or perhaps local basis?
They're much better addressed on a regional or a local basis so that each country, each state, or whatever can work to secure their own environmental, economic, and security issues. I mean, we need bottom-up solutions to all these problems, not top-down mandates like the UN and World Economic Forum have tried to impose on everybody. I mean, the Paris Agreement, we've seen Malay withdraw, and now Trump has withdrawn. I think this is going to start a number of different countries withdrawing from the global agreement.
But what would you then say to people from various Pacific communities like Tuvalu or the Marshall Islands who are facing a very precipitous rise in the in their sea levels, and their officials like giving speeches, public speeches, standing knee high in the water to sort of dramatize the impact. Would you just tell them, okay, guys, you know, bad luck, nature had it coming your way?
Okay, two issues. First off, the sea level rise issue is complex. You have to look at each individual location and see what's going on. Often, a lot of what's going on is sinking, where the land is sinking, either geologically or because of groundwater extraction or even fossil fuel extraction. So a lot of the so-called sea level rise problems are caused by sinking, not by the sea level rise. The other thing is, even if you blame all of the sea level rise on humans, and it's still not a lot, it's basically like 9 inches over the last 100 years. It's not a lot. Even if you blame it all on humans, if we were to stop emitting fossil fuels now, and even if you believe the climate models, it would take several hundred years for this to reverse. We can't unring this particular bell. There's a lot of inertia and very long time scales in the oceans and the ice sheets. So even if we stopped emitting, the sea level is going to continue to do what it wants to do.
Mm-hmm. And even, you know, I don't know what the people of Tuvalu can do, but I think it's pretty clear that large industrial countries like the United States or Russia, for that matter, you know, can do a lot of things by making sure that the hydrants have enough water and that they have, you know, well-functioning early warning systems, either for the hurricanes or perhaps for wildfires. And that brings us back to this very mundane issue of governance and what is it for and how do you invest your time, your resources, whether you're investing into some abstract future aversion goal or whether you are trying to deal with boring, mundane, but still resource-requiring issues of the present day. Do you have anything to say on that?
Well, I think we need to focus on the local and regional issues. I mean, the climate crisis is really a summation of thousands of local vulnerabilities. That because we live on coastal regions, in floodplains, and various vulnerable places like that. And all of this can be exacerbated to some small extent by global warming, but most of it, it's population increased and increasing property in vulnerable regions. So, you know, we need to confront that and we need to increase our resilience. We need better warnings. We need better infrastructure. We need better water management. We need to harden our electric utilities so they're less vulnerable to extreme weather. There's all sorts of things that we can do. And again, it's mundane, but it's going to make people's lives better, and it's going to reduce the large economic losses associated with these weather disasters when they do occur.
Okay, well, Professor Curry, we have to leave it there, but thank you very much for highlighting that we get into the future by tending to the present, not the other way around. I think that's very important to keep in mind.
Okay, good. Thank you.
And thank you for watching. Hope to see you again on Worlds Apart.